Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Maryland sports fans, there's only one sports book in the great state of Maryland with over 50 years experience booking bets and supporting customers. Betfred Sportsbook at Longshots is now open and is the only sports book in Frederick offering cash betting on football, basketball, world soccer, and more. Visit the Betfred Sportsbook at I-270 and MD-85 in Frederick, right next to Longshots off-track betting. Go to BetfredSports.com for more information and your chance to win exclusive merchandise. Must be 21 or older. Play responsibly. For help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Hey, I'm Paul Stevenson, and this is episode 75 of Vintage Rock Pod, the ultimate classic rock podcast with big-name interview shows every Monday, just like this one, and short 4 or 5 minute daily episodes released Tuesday through Sunday on a show I call This Day Rocks. If this is your first time listening, please find Vintage Rock Pod on your podcast app or player of choice and subscribe directly on there so you don't miss a single episode. As I said, one comes out every single day and you'll only get all those episodes on the Vintage Rock Pod feed, so give it a like or subscribe separately on there too, please. Now, today's guest is someone I've been trying to get on the show for ages. I checked back the email trail, and I first reached out on the 13th of October 2021, so literally just over a year it took to get him on the show. Now, he may not be a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer or even a mainstream household name, but he has been a pioneer throughout his career. Now, I love this quote from music journalist Tim Sommer, who wrote an article in LA Weekly in 2017, where the opening paragraph read, "In the mid and late 1980s, you couldn't throw a drink ticket in LA without hitting a group that were created in this one band's image. The whole platinum, spiky and rouged middle of the decade looked like them. From the singers with the serpentine hips, to the skipping, swirling guitar players wearing attitudinal hats, to the two cool, vested rhythm guitarists, it all had its roots in Hanoi Rocks." Now, Hanoi Rocks are a band from Finland who broke out of there and changed the world in their own way. They were the first Finnish group to chart in the UK. They set the tone, and many acknowledge they set the blueprint for the look of the hair metal scene. The classic lineup is considered Michael Munro on vocals, Andy McCoy lead guitar and principal songwriter, Nasty Suicide on rhythm guitar, Sami Jaffa on the bass, and the drums first by Jip Casino and then by Razzle. Their music, though, it's hard to define. I know we said the whole hair metal thing, but it was raw, it was edgy, it was spiky, it was fast, and yet very melodic, incredibly so, catchy choruses and sing-along hooks. Their live performances are legendary. I went down a rabbit hole of YouTube watching so many of their live performances, and the energy that came off the stage in the 80s was incredible. I definitely urge you to check them out. Sounds magazine in the UK even voted them the second best band in the world at one point. The Manic Street Preachers, Skid Row and Foo Fighters have all publicly acknowledged being Hanoi Rocks fans. Bret Michaels and NoFX have both mentioned Hanoi Rocks in songs of theirs. And even the new big TV show Peacemaker, the character himself, says Hanoi Rocks, only the greatest band of all time. But despite their influence, despite their love, the cult status, they never got the wider commercial success they deserved, mainly in part due to the tragic circumstances which led to the band breaking up in the mid-80s. On their first tour of the US in 1984, the group's drummer, Razzle, was at a party at Motley Crue singer Vince Neil's house. Razzle got in the car with Vince to go find more alcohol. Vince hit another car. Razzle died instantly. The occupants of the other car suffered serious injuries, and Vince was sentenced to 30 days in prison. Now, prior to this, the band had, just months earlier, released Two Steps From The Move, a brilliant album produced by legendary music producer Bob Ezrin. This album would have been the big breakthrough, if you ask me. In fact, this was the album that got a 16-year-old me into Hanoi Rocks. I was working in a bar at the time, too young to serve alcohol, of course, but I was there to collect empty glasses, wash them, stack the shelves in the bar, that sort of thing, but also help out in the kitchen when the food orders got busy. Now, in the kitchen, the head chef would always play some sort of crazy rock, and one day I was working there, I remember him asking me if I'd ever heard of a band called Hanoi Rocks. No, I said. So he put on Two Steps From The Move, and that was me hooked. So as a big fan, you can imagine my delight when I finally secured an interview with the band's charismatic lead singer, an icon in Finland, a man who's just turned 60, Michael Munro. But before we hear my chat with him, I'm going to flip the show on its head this week because I want to make sure that anyone not aware of the group gets a chance to hear some snippets first. So today, I'm going to start with the top fives, and I really enjoyed listening again to the band's back catalogue and re-immersing myself with their stuff as well. I mean, it's criminally underrated, and, well, perhaps that's not even the right word. I mean, criminally underexposed. Maybe that's better. So here you go. For anyone that loves the band, be kind. For anyone unaware of the band, take these five as a starting point. So here you go. My top five songs from Hanoi Rocks. At 5 is a track from the Two Steps From The Move album. Songwriter credits on this are Andy McCoy, Bob Ezrin, and the legend that is Ian Hunter. A big chant-along chorus, a fan's favourite, at 5, is Boulevard of Broken Dreams. At 4 is a track from their 1983 album Back to Mystery City. Originally, McCoy didn't like the song he'd written, but Razzle loved it, so the band went with it, and Andy grew to love it. At 4 is Until I Get You. My number 3 is the opening track on 1982's Oriental Beat album. Another really upbeat number. It drips with raucous energy when it's done live. And number 3 is Motivated. Now, my number 1 and 2 flipped so many times before I had to commit, and right now the song I've picked at 2 is another from the Two Steps From The Move album. It shifts in tempo and feel throughout the song. The intro and build-up is moody, and as long-time listeners know, I like a dark and brooding track, but it cuts in with a swagger-filled verse full of attitude, and then the melodic big sing-along chorus. And speaking of the chorus, Guns N' Roses took the line Welcome to the Jungle from this chorus to make a little song for themselves. And number 2 is Underwater World. Welcome to the ocean. Welcome to the sea. Welcome to the jungle. Deep inside of me. And at number 1, I've gone for a track from their debut album, Bangkok Rocks, Shanghai Shakes, Hanoi Rocks. It's punky and full of fire and has all the ingredients of a Hanoi classic. Andy wrote this when he was just 15 or 16 years old, which is incredible. And given what happened with Razzle and the band, the title becomes even more poignant. My favourite song, and number 1 on my list of Hanoi Rocks tracks, is Tragedy. Life is like tragedy. So there you go, my top 5 songs from Hanoi Rocks. Hopefully that gives you a good idea of the group going into this interview with Michael. As always, though, I'd love to hear your thoughts on my top 5. Email me, vintagerockpod@gmail.com, or you can find me on the social media channels. Just search for Vintage Rock Pod on all the usual sites, you know, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, that sort of thing. You'll find me on them. Let me know what your top 5 picks are. Let you know what you think of my selection as well. Come say hello, and you'll get a mention on next Monday's big interview show. Speaking of interviews, let's get onto it then. Here we go with Michael. He's a wonderful guest. He was at home in Finland when we spoke, and he's just returned from New York. He spent much of the summer touring and opening for Guns N' Roses and Alice Cooper across Europe, so you're going to get to hear all about that. He's so busy as well. You get to hear the full lowdown on his new movie, his latest album, the re-release of another album, a finally remastered version of a Hanoi classic. He talks about Razzle, the band, Slash, Axl Rose, Alice Cooper, working with the legend that is Bob Ezrin, and so much more. Please enjoy this extended interview with the wonderful Michael Munro. So I saw recently on your social media that you're over in New York and you'd met with Stephen Van Zandt and Ian Hunter, I mean two legends, and you were there because you were filming more parts for your new movie, your new documentary. So let's start with that then. I mean, tell us about meeting those legends and what you were doing there and a bit more about this movie, this documentary about your life.
Yeah, well, it's a documentary that's been in the works for over 2 years now. I've been filming it. It's a story about my life, my career, and from the beginning to this day. And a lot of stuff has happened actually during the filming, and that's really interesting. It's going to be called The Best Kept Secret in Rock and Roll. And it's going to be an interesting movie to anybody who's maybe not even into rock and roll or me. It'll be an interesting story. And we've had a lot of stuff happen in the process. There's some really moving scenes, too, that have happened. Me speaking with my mother about remembering Razzle, and she got all moved, and she remembers him coming to visit us a couple of times. And then the Hanoi Rocks second album, Oriental Beat, the remixing of that whole process was documented because the tapes were thought to have been lost, and relocated.
That's right, yeah.
So, and we have now remixed, and 4 years later, the album finally gets the sound it deserves. and of course, the remastering and reissue of Demolition 23 and my newest album, and we filmed some stuff on tour. We were opening for Alice Cooper in June, and we had a cool chat with Alice in his hotel room in Milan, which we filmed. I basically let Alice talk because he has such cool stories from the early days. And we've interviewed tons of people from Bob Ezrin to, Slash, of course, and Chris Chivett. Joe Elliott's going to be in tons of people from my life. And of course, Little Steven had to be. He was one of the most important, he's been a really dear friend for many years and all my years in America, especially. And Ian Hunter, of course, always been a big hero. And, we went to his house in Connecticut and had a great talk.
Nice.
All the people that have been a part of my life from the beginning. There's so much great material. It's going to be tough to leave stuff out to make it into the movie. But it'll be something else. I'm looking forward to it being finished. It's supposed to come out now. The end of January next year, 2023.
Ah, so not too long for us to wait then. I mean, what other footage is in there? Have you got kind of previously unseen footage, some of the old stuff?
Yeah. There's all kinds of stuff. Pete Eklund is a guy who's been making it. He's done a huge amount of research and interviewed tons of people and gone through tons of material throughout the years, and really has done a thorough job going through my life. And it's got a great vision. And I had to rethink a lot of the old events, like for example, did I make the right decision by telling them to pull the commercial when they were at Michael Munro, the brains behind Hanoi Rocks? He found that advert somewhere, the TV ad, and I was like, well, it is corny. It's corny. And if I'd known that they were going to pull the plug on the whole record, I might have, just let it be. But then again, I would have had to live with it. So I made the right decision in the end. But it's like things are, situation where I have to really there's many real situations where, as it happens, I have to he hasn't made it easy on me, which is good. So, and he had also interviewed Andy McCoy, who I had nothing to do with for 12 years. And Andy was in in a space at the time in his state of mind. He was really open and looking at himself too, like admitting that he'd he's been a prick for many times. It's been many years that he'd been really kind of like owned up on a lot of stuff. And he actually called me the next day after the interview to apologize.
Oh, wow.
For being, it's like, that's the first ever. I was like, wow, where did this come from? I was like, well, of course I accept it's hard to forget. Some of the stuff is like the worst, you know, it was such a nightmare at times, but still it's like, wow, this is improvement. Things like that. It making the movie has sparked a lot of stuff and caused a lot of things. And I'm sure it has had something to do with the fact that we got the original lineup of Hanoi Rocks at my 60th birthday show, got that together, and all that's been documented too. So it's a lot of interesting stuff. There's been like a lot of closures and stuff that have happened during the filming of it. So it's very exciting, and it's a perfect time. The timing has been perfect. I'm really glad that Pete is making that documentary, and he's doing a great job. So I'm looking forward to it myself.
I'm really looking forward to it. It sounds fascinating. It sounds like it's healing some old wounds as well, which is always lovely to hear, especially at this stage of life.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Now being 60 is like, well, the new album, Live Too Fast to Die Young, it says it all, and I can't die young anymore.
Absolutely. Now, you've got a huge following here in the UK. Obviously, we'll start with that, but with the likes of Hanoi Rocks, they were huge. I mean, Hanoi was the first Finnish band to have a charting success over here in the UK and get on the charts, and it was incredible. You spent a lot of time here, you record records here. What did you make of your time in London, in the UK? Because you toured as well all over the UK. I mean, what did you make of your time here and the music scene at that point in the early 80s?
Well, it was a great time. It was a lot of learning, and I was, you know, just in the beginning. And we relocated to London, and after we started out on the streets of Stockholm, I mean, first thing we wanted to do was get out of Finland and out of Helsinki. In Stockholm, me and Nasty Suicide and Sammy Alpha, we were on the streets homeless for the first 6 months. Andy wasn't, because he had a girlfriend. But then we relocated to London eventually in like 81, 82, and lived there. And I loved living in London, and there was not much of a scene there. So we kind of, it was us and Los of a New Church was another band that was like happening there in the early 80s. And we kind of created a scene at we had a residency at the Marquee. We played once a week, and everybody came to see Hanoi. All from hippies to heavy metal to teddy boys to even skinheads, anybody, you know, we combined, and punks and everybody. So we crossed all the barriers, crossed over to a multitude of people from different walks of life, which was great. And I thought there was also one of the best things about Hanoi, that we defied all categories, that, you know, they tried to call us heavy metal or punk, and then they came up with the glam thing, and it was like, well, whatever you call it, it's rock and roll. And we played anything from punk to calypso. And so couldn't really pin us down and say what we were. But we were a good rock band and had our own thing. And we became, like, after Razzle joined especially, he had a great sense of humor and a lot of the English kind of sense of humor. And we became the darlings of the press. All the Melody Maker articles from New York to Israel and India.
Yeah.
Chewing up the Big Apple and Havoc in the Holy Land, and what was with Carol Clark, God rest her soul. Carol Clark was wonderful, and Justin Thomas, the photographer. Justin's actually Pete Eklund, Pete, the maker of my documentary. He flew Justin Thomas over to my 60th birthday concert. He was over there.
Beautiful.
So it was a great time, everybody loved Hanoi, and we were on our way to becoming a big band, and except NME was the only magazine that hated everybody. they had a hard time, but it was a cool time, and it was a cool scene back then. And then after that, London became kind of sad, you know, for me. And recovering from that, from losing a dear friend like Russell, and such a great guy, it was really a hard time. And we really probably should have taken a break, but we couldn't. And I guess, or at least we were told that, you know, we should keep going. And mm-hmm. Sammy Afa left the band, which also made it, you know, hard to continue. So there was only me and Andy and Nasty left, and we weren't really connecting at the time. And so my only friend I felt was Steve Bader's at the time, and we were, you know, really tight. And he was when he was on tour, I was taking care of his cat. His cat Ziggy. we decided to move in together because he had a cool flat in Portobello. So that was that summer. Even though, regardless of the Hanoi tragedy and losing the band of my life, I didn't know what to do. I just wanted to stop Hanoi from becoming something that it wasn't. Because had we continued with the replacement for Razzle and Sammy, it wouldn't have been the same.
Yeah.
So I didn't want the world to get to know Hanoi as the way it was not. Like, you know, the original band was so special, like a family. And
yeah, absolutely.
Then Little Steven came over to produce the Lord's Prayer song, single. And then I had been a fan of Steven's since the Voice of America album was a big thing for me. So I met him, and I thought, you know, these are the two coolest people, the only people I need to hang with. And and Steven came. He had never heard of Hanoi, and he actually, Steve showed him a video of Hanoi. I think it was Boulevard of Broken Dreams, and Steven flipped over it. He was like, "Wow,
this understandable." Yeah. Yeah.
So then I said, "Well, you know, unfortunately, we broke up, and the drummer died, and all." So then Steven, you know, wanted to support my solo career, and he came to play some 12-string guitar on my demos that I was making at the time, and sang some backing vocals. And then he invited me and Steve to be part of the Sun City project.
Nice.
Right. Remember, that was like the song that made everyone aware of what was going on in South Africa, and no bands could go and play the holiday resort and make millions pretending that they didn't know what was going on, apartheid, and Mandela was in jail and all that. So I was really proud to be part of that. Sang some backing vocals with Steve, and then we flew over to London to New York to make the video. We'd be a part of the Sun City video, and that was really cool. The group scene in Washington Square Park with everybody from Bob Dylan to Bono and Bob Geldof and Bruce Springsteen, and Miles Davis even played on the song. It's like Joe Ramone and Run DMC and all these cool people. Some of the coolest and biggest names in rock: Ringo Starr, Zach Starkey, Keith Richards, Ronnie Wood, Pete Townsend. All these people. It's like, This is where I belong. I thought, I want to move here, and I want to just restart.
Living the dream, absolutely.
Yeah. Start over in New York, you know, start my solo career. Because Steve was the one. I said, you know, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know. I said, well, start a solo career. I said, well, I guess so. And that's when I started, like, I came onto my own as a songwriter. Because Hanoi and Andy had some great stuff always, and he always said, oh, I got a better one here. So I kind of let him write songs, and I didn't, you know, write much myself. But then... Mm. During my solo career, I came onto my own as a songwriter, and based on my admiration of Steve and Little Stevens, and Voice of America, Lords of Miniatures, and Steve, and then the punk thing, telling the truth, writing relevant lyrics and lyrics that meant something and could move people and maybe raise questions. And you know, Steve always taught that the lyrics are the deadliest weapon or tools for positive action. So it was just as important as the music. And I started working on my solo career in New York, restarted my life. And that's how that came about. But the London, those years were important. You know, really, we were learning all the time, and we had created a big buzz there. And, cool.
Yeah.
And we were the first band ever to come out, to leave Finland, because Finnish people are kind of, they're humble by birth. I think for some, the Finnish character usually is very like, you know, I'm nothing, and you know, why bother? And you know, let's go to the big world, that they can have it. And I don't even speak the language, you know. So we thought, like, of course, we want to be, you know, first thing we wanted to do is get out of Finland. And we opened a lot of doors afterwards, you know, for bands like, I could hear a bands like him, you know, Rasmus, and before Hanoi, no, it didn't occur to people that here artists that they could leave the country, and they just thought it, you know, didn't think it was possible. So that, but Hanoi, I think me and Hanoi have exceptionally, we've left our mark, you know.
Absolutely. You were pioneers without a shadow of a doubt in many different aspects, in many different realms. But I just want to take you back quickly to something you mentioned just a few minutes ago about the remaking of the Oriental Beat album, which was recorded in London. You weren't happy with the album as it came out at the time. I mean, it's gone down. Fans love it. But it never sat right with you or the band, did it? So tell us what you're doing with it now.
No, well, the way it was mixed, the producer at the time, I don't know what he was going for, but it was something just totally wrong. For whatever reason, we had some tapes of some rough mixes at the time, and we thought it was going to be fine. So we were already on tour in Finland at the time when we heard the record, the mix for the first time, and it was already pressed onto vinyl.
Too late.
So we thought, oh, it can't be changed. And I thought, it sounds kind of hollow, and, you know, it's pretty much like just snare drum and vocal, and there's no, we were a guitar band, and there was like no guitars, and it was really a strange mix. And but we thought, you know, it couldn't be changed. And had I known what I know now, of course, we would have, you know, went back and said, no, screw this. Let's start over. We're going to mix it again. But that's the way it was put out. And it's a shame because I think that probably set us back for a year or two, maybe, because of the sound of the record. Because it had great songs, but the sound was really, really bad. In the worst possible way, it was screwed up. So, but still, we wanted to remix it in the early 90s when Guns N' Roses released our European catalog in the States. We wanted to remix that record. And then the Finnish label said, the head of the Finnish label said that they sent the multi-track tapes to Germany for someone to mix, to remix. And the tapes had been lost. And we're like, what? How can they send the original tapes? Didn't they have safety copies? And as it turned out, I found out a couple of years ago that it was not true that the original tapes were always in Finland, and Universal Music owns them now. So I had a tip from somebody who had been at their warehouse and had seen some multi-track tapes by Hanoi. And I got in touch with the head of the label, and I says, can you please have somebody go out there and take a photo of the tapes? And if it says At Vision Studios, London, then those are the Oriental Beat tapes. And they were. So we're like, wow, now we can make it, really remix it finally. And so we started doing it. We had this guy, E-Studio in Helsinki, this guy, Petri Myri, who's done my previous album, previous four albums, except for the, he's mixed all my previous albums, except for the new one.
Yeah.
I've worked with him for many years. And So he started working on the stuff, and then me and Sammy went into the studio for a couple of times, and it was sounding really great. And then Andy, of course, wanted to have his say, and so I called him, and we met for the first time for 12 years. Hadn't seen him since the rebirth of Hanoi. Yeah. In 2009, when we finished that, I had no reason to be in touch with him. And I must say, at the time, I decided that I never want to see that guy again. Now I called him and I said, okay, look, whatever your problem is, let's get to this. Let's go to the studio and you tell me what you want, and then we'll have it. I mean, you know, it would be silly if we couldn't cooperate. And it was such an important thing. And the longest project ever for an album, 40 years. And finally now, it has the sound it deserves. So, and Andy actually did have good points for it. And then we sent that version to everybody. I mean, Jip Casino, Sammy Afa, and Nasty Suicide, everybody was involved in this process all the time. Yeah. We sent the versions to be heard, and everybody said their comments, and everybody liked them, and even Richard Bishop, the other manager, you know. And we finally got the result that we were all happy with, and now it's coming out in November. I think it's available to order already. This is the 40th anniversary year, so we made it so that it's going to be, it's the 40th anniversary, 21st century edition, the real mix, not only the
real mix. That's the one. Brilliant. Can't wait to hear that as well. I mean, let's find another name that you've already mentioned, Bob Ezrin. I mean, he came over, he watched you guys play. I mean, this is a guy that had worked on the Wall with Pink Floyd. He'd worked with Alice Cooper on many albums, and Kiss, and I don't know, Aerosmith and Lou Reed and Peter Gabriel. I mean, honestly, he'd worked with some huge superstars. Now, what was your feeling when you found out that he wanted to work with you guys and he wanted to take you over to New York to record? And I mean, how must have that felt at the time?
I thought it was brilliant. I mean, he was like, holy, you know, he's a holy man. And he had done all the earlier Alice Cooper albums. They're like my absolute favorites. I was like, so happy that I know Steve wanted to have him produce the Lords of the New Church. And I asked him why he didn't produce it. He says, the name was too long. he was into producing Hanoi. And we really needed that at the time. I think it was, he felt about Hanoi like he kind of felt the same as he felt about the Alice Cooper band. It was going to be a longer relationship. We were planning to make the next album with him and the next one too. And it would have been a great relationship. So he came to see our gig, and then he wanted to meet me. He was staying with David Gilmour, Gilmour's house in Maida Vale. Yeah, and they were working on the About Face album, which is actually a great record. It's one of my favorites too. He was at Gilmour's house. Gilmour wasn't home, but it was one of his three houses, I think, and it was a cool place. So Andy was kind of agitated. He was like, why does he want to meet you? I write most of the songs. And he was like, well, I don't know. I mean, he'd seen our show. So Bob just wanted to talk to me about what he saw on stage. And for me, he had some good tips about, you know, how he had, you know, like some moves, like what I do with my hands. If I get people to clap and then I do something else, it's confusing to them. That I just give them time and then, you know, put my hands down so people, because they follow your hands, and little tips like that. And he said, how many times did you get up on a PA? And I said, I don't know, maybe one, maybe two, twice, three times. I counted 7. I said, yeah, so? He says, well, you know, you go up there once, people go, yeah, wow. And the second time maybe, but after that, you lose the impact. So he said, you don't want to do it too much. And I was like, oh, that's a good point. You know, so things like that he wanted to talk to me about. And he also wanted to talk about Andy. He says, there's one guy, it's a difficult case, but he reminds me of Glenn Buxton of the Alice Cooper band, but I can handle him. Well, you mean Andy? I just, yep. So he was, but he dealt with Andy. Well, you know, he had his peculiar sides, and he was really good with him in the studio. And I remember Andy being pissy about stuff. So I go, I can make you play that solo over and over again. Then he combines. I don't like the way he combined it. It was like, but it was still okay. At the end of the recording session, I mean, we learned. It was like a learning experience. I learned a hell of a lot. We all learned. That's when we all became professional, so to speak. Mm-hmm. With Bob, and he ran a tight ship, but he had a great sense of humor, and it was really, I had a good time too. And I was really skinny at the time. Came to a point where I stopped everything, what I've been doing, whatever, you know, speed and hash and smoking and stuff. And I realized that singing, because Bob maybe takes vocal lessons, and I realized it's very physical singing and performing on stage, that the better shape I'm in, the better I do it. So decided to quit everything. I'm drinking, I never liked anyways, but I just decided to start exercising and being healthy and good shape. And I didn't know how to eat to balance that. So I got really skinny. I was like really skin and bone. And people thought, what are you doing, speed or something? You're so skinny. I was like, no, I've never been healthier in my life, you know. So I started swimming every day and whenever I could. And then even Bob was saying, come on, have a donut. Come on, you need to put on some weight before you go on the road. You know, you can't look like that. But I was still, you know, without knowing, I guess I had some kind of liquid diet, I guess. Because I was, you know, I would get up, I would go run to the swimming pool, swim for an hour or two maybe, and then have some muesli or... And then some salad for dinner and yogurt, and that's all, you know. And so I lost all my weight. But I guess I was anorexic in a way, a little bit too. And maybe it was my way of saying, you know, up yours to everybody. You know, what's this? I'm skinnier than Andy, even though Andy was skinny. He never had the muscle tone because it's the only exercise he did, you know. But it was really a learning experience. And we did the pre-production in at first we did some in London and then in Toronto, and then we recorded the basic tracks in at the record plant in, yep. in New York, and then went back to Toronto to finish the album. And it was great because it was at the, in the studio building there. Also, there was a swimming pool there, so I went to swim. The guys, they almost resented me for not drinking 24 hours like they did. You know, there was a fire alarm at the hotel in Toronto. It was like it was a high rise building and like many 70 floors or something. And then I've heard a fire alarm, and I was in a bath, and I was like, you know, my hair was wet, and I was put on my jeans and t-shirt and went outside and freezing. It was cold winter. And then there actually was a fire in the kitchen, but then they got it under control. So everybody went back into the building. But I was like, wait a minute, where did the guys go? What happened with them? And I went to knock on whoever's room it was. They were all in the same room. They didn't give a shit. They were like drinking the same. I was like, bang the door. You guys realize there was a fire emergency just now? Oh, come on, lighten up. What are you worried about? Come on, chill, man. Have a drink. Okay, whatever. They were sitting there. They didn't give a hoot. They just kept on partying. But yeah, so that was a really, really great experience with Bob. And Bob was really upset when Russell died. He was really, really upset about that. He was angry and he was mad. He was like, God damn it, why did that happen? And because he really wanted to work with us, and we would have worked with him in the future. And he taught me how to, you know, this warm up thing with my voice. When I was husky and before the vocal of Boulevard of Broken Dreams, I said, you know, my voice is shot and I feel like shit. And he said, hey, come on, man. Okay, come here, do this. And he showed me this kind of exercise where you massage your vocal cords and you sing in a low key, low tone, you know, for a while softly. And then you get your voice back. And he says, okay, sing like that for an hour. We've gone out to dinner. I was like, come on, man. Then, but after a while, I was like, wait a minute, my voice came back, and he was right. So he came back. So how are you feeling? I said, oh, I feel good. Okay, let's do the vocal. You know? So he was really good, like a coach like that. And I remember us doing four-part harmonies for the Boiler song, the Boiler, Me Boiler and Me, because he loved Razzle and his Cockney accent. He wanted to have that on the record and had Razzle speak on Cutting Corners and in Don't You Believe Me, too. But then had the Boiler song. We had the four-part harmony, and when we're doing all four of us around the mics doing the vocal, and Russell was standing there with a beer, Bob storms into the room with a fire extinguisher, goes with the foam spraying on everybody. Everybody else jumped up. We all were like, "What?" But Russell just kept standing there. "Hello, Bobo. How you doing, babe? What's up with the foam?" It's like all covered in foam. He didn't move a bit. It was just like, "How you doing, Bobo?" Bob was really, he was whipping Razzle because Razzle wasn't used to working so hard, but he got everything out of Razzle that he needed. And in the end, Razzle was fine. It was great. Great job. So, yeah.
Absolutely fascinating. Love hearing these sorts of stories. I mean, can I just touch on the fact that we mentioned that you guys were pioneers and you said it was difficult to label you as punk, as metal, and they invented glam and this, that, and the other. I mean, you guys have always been known as one of the most influential groups of your era, in effect. I mean, you get cited by the likes of the Foo Fighters and Skid Row and the Manic Street Preachers and Guns N' Roses have all come out and openly said that you guys have been influences to them. And then you've got the Headbangers Ball documentary cited you as one of the most influential bands. And then LA Weekly came out with their list of the top hair metal bands. And I think that was only 2013. And they had you guys at number one. I mean, how does it feel to hear that kind of thing? But at the same time, you never managed to get that critical kind of commercial success in the US when you really should have done, given the fact that you guys are so influential and your music is such loved.
Yeah, it's always great to get any kind of recognition. It's really cool, especially when it's the right kind of recognition and people who understand what the band was about. I think with Hanoi Rocks, the record sales never reflected our fame and our, you know, it never translated into record sales or money or that kind of monetary success. So, but I think what we achieved was it's harder to achieve and more. I'd rather have the integrity that we have than have commercial success that would, you know, that anybody can have pretty much. You're lucky enough, you know. So we had something more meaningful.
Yeah.
And that to me, that means a lot more to me than so that's why I'm not I'm not sorry I never became a millionaire, you know. It's like money doesn't really get you happiness anyway. So we did something of a lasting value. And yeah, that's more important than that. That I feel kind of proud of, you know, in my own career, that I never compromised for the wrong reasons. And that's the reason I broke up Hanoi Rocks after Russell died, because I didn't want it to become something that it wasn't in the parody of itself. And I thought at least one band should stick to their guns and not sell out and not do it for the money, you know. So therefore, I think, and I think that's why there's a lot of respect for Hanoi and myself in the industry by even the big names, because I've always, you know, walked my own path and uncompromisingly and never sold out, never sold my soul, and stay true to myself and you know, get doing this from the heart, and then sticking it out throughout the years. And like little Steven said something cool in his interview that Pete told me in the documentary interview. He said, like, you know, it's okay to have a hit and stuff like that, but, you know, try and stick it out for 40 years and without a hit, then that's something. That takes some doing, and that's what Michael has done.
Brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Now, we've mentioned what happened with Razzle, and then after Hanoi, you then had an ill-fated project, shall we say, with Jerusalem Slim, and you labelled that once probably the worst part of your career. But then following that, we had Demolition 23, which I heard you again say in another interview was probably one of the best times of your career, especially in the recording studio, because it came together so nicely, everything fell into place, it came together quickly, which was a stark contrast to what had happened with Steve Stevens. Now, Demolition 23, it's a little-known project, and he kind of got a small release in effect at the time. But thankfully, we're getting the full release now, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was everything that went wrong with the Jerusalem Slim Steve Stevens project, we did right with Demolition 23. And having little Steven as the producer, although I didn't have a big record deal, which I had with Not Faking It and Jerusalem Slim, I had to get dropped off the label because I owed him a huge amount of money, and it was didn't make sense staying there. It took about a year. When I was finally dropped by the label, I was free to do and to use little Steven as the producer, which Polygram didn't let me use for the Steven's project, which would have saved that project. So Steven had, now finally I called Steven, hey, I'm free, and you know, to do it. Now we can make the record that I always wanted. And having him as the producer, it was easy. I could trust him completely. And having the band, after we got the band together with Sammy Alpha and Jay Henning and Jimmy Clark, it was it didn't take more than, it was 3 days of recording the basic tracks and two days vocals. So, and that was, then we mixed it song per day, and that was it. And in about 2 weeks, the whole album was done. And it's still one of the best albums I've done. I think Not Faking It and Demolition 23 are my favorite albums from the past.
You know? Yeah.
And now it's been, all these years I've been talking to Steven about it, we have to release it, because it only came out on, we didn't have a big label. It came out on Music for Nations in Europe and on Mercury Records in Japan. And it was big in Japan, and we toured there and stuff, but never came out in the States. And Steven, at the time, he went shopping at the record labels. He took the album to the big labels, and they said, oh, punk is dead. So, you know, it was more than punk. It was authentic and good rock music and with the punky edge. And so nobody was interested at the time. And this was maybe a half a year or a year later, all this Green Day stuff came out and then became a big, big thing. So once again, I was ahead of my time, you know, right place at the wrong time or whatever, you know, same with Hanoi, kind of, you know, in the States. So it was just a shame, because it was a great record and a great band. And what happened with Jay Henning, I mean, it's a sad story. He was a fantastic guitar player. He would have been a superstar, and he was just fantastic. And unfortunately, he had some problems. Well, he broke his leg. He's hit by a car, and took a half a year before we could go. And we waited for a half a year for him to recover. And then a couple of weeks before the first tour, we were going to go to England and then play in the London Astoria show, and then Finland and Japan. He got arrested in Alphabet City. He was scoring, because he had a bit of a habit, and which he was struggling with and trying to get rid of him. So I had to get Nasty Suicide to replace him at the last minute. And we had like one rehearsal and then hit the stage with Astoria. And me and Sammy and Nasty had not played since Hanoi had broken up. So that was the first time three of us were together again. And it was a great show. It went well. And then we went to Japan and out to Finland and then Japan. At the Finnish press conference, Nasty said that he wants to join the band permanently. I says, well, okay, great. I wasn't going to say no because, you know, we didn't have a guitar player then. So, but then in 1995, Nasty decided to stop playing rock and roll altogether. And he went to study to be a pharmacist. Yeah. He is now. And we came back to New York and I was disappointed, disillusioned. And I felt like, you know, couldn't find another guitar player. And the music business was what it was. Music had no business in the music business. I was just like fed up with the whole thing. And that's when I decided to move out of New York.
Yeah. So in terms of this re-release then that we're getting now for Demolition 23, I mean, we've had a sneak peek, one of the singles, again, another London connection, Hammersmith Palais. What are we going to get from this re-release then? Is it all mastered versions of the songs? Are we getting any bonus extra tracks? I mean, is it coming out in special vinyl? Give us a lowdown on it all.
All of those.
All above.
Yeah. It's been remastered. I was there and it's really, it sounds much better than before even. It's kicking ass more. It's got more drums, more balls. And it's got three bonus tracks. There are three demos we made. We recorded at the Baby Monster Studios on 14th Street that were Hammersmith Palais and Dysfunctional and The Scum Lives On. Those three songs, and I had them on an audio cassette, and I didn't digitalize them. Some years ago, I got them in the digital form, and that was the only tape in existence. So luckily, I saved all this stuff over the years and kept to myself. So three bonus tracks, the demos that we made before we went to the studio, and it never came out on vinyl, so it's got a vinyl coming out on vinyl with a cover, gatefold cover that Rich Jones, who was been doing making my past four albums I dug out some old photos and stuff, and we made a nice package together. There's a poster, and the bonus tracks are available on this card thing, and on the CD. The bonus tracks are on the CD. CD comes out also with a new booklet with some liner notes. I wrote something about every song, and you know, and then wrote the story about the album and stuff. And it's dedicated to. It was originally dedicated to Steve Bader's. At the time. So now it's also dedicated to the memory of Jay Henning's memory, because he took his own life in 97. So that's also that. And Bedtime Story is the last song I wrote for Steve, and kind of with him after he passed away. And it's got 11 Steve Bader songs from all throughout his career within the lyrics. And I even played that one at my birthday concert is acoustically.
Fantastic.
Quite proud of that too. And that the album just came together perfectly. So now it's great. I've been talking to Steven for years and years. It was like 21 years now. Like, we've got to get this out. It's got to be available. It's out of print and nobody has it. Nobody knows it. And now finally, about a year ago or so, Steven said, yeah, let's do it. And so, all right. And I went in to master it, and we worked on the cover, and it's a nice package. It's really, really coming out nicely. And having Demolition 23 be the support band at my 60th birthday concert, we did, you know, five songs. Nothing's All Right, Dysfunctional, and Endangered Species, and You Crucified Me in Hammersmith Palais.
Sounds fantastic. And you mentioned in terms of the remastering that it's now a kick-ass album. It's a big ballsy record. And that leads us on to your recent release. I mean, that is a kick-ass record. That is a big ballsy record. It came out just earlier this year, didn't it? A couple of months ago. As we said, it's I Live Too Fast to Die Young, which is the name of one of the tracks as well. Now, let's start off with that. It's a fantastic name. Where did that name come from?
Well, that was the song. When the song came about, we had like 34 songs last summer. I narrowed it down to 11 in the end, and it was a good problem to have. But when that song came about, I thought that's the name of
the album.
That's
the one, yeah.
It's this time in my, you know, I'm 60. I just turned 60 in June, and the album came out on June 10th. And so we were touring with Alice Cooper, and I felt better than ever. And I thought, you know, I can't die young anymore. And we tend to reinvent old cliches, like live fast, die young is a boring old cliche, and it's nothing cool about dying young. So Live Too Fast to Die Young was a perfect title for my record. And and then as we were making it, I was with the track listing, I thought of, you know, the first song is Murder to Summer Love, Murder to Summer Love. And the second to last song is A Little Too Fast to Die Young. And the last song, Dearly Departed. So it was just like this death theme that appeared in a positive way. I thought, oh, that's a sign that this is the track listing. And all this, it went perfectly together. And we went into a new studio that I had never been to before in Helsinki. It's a place called Inkfish. And had this guy, Erno Laitinen, who was an engineer who actually became more than an engineer in the process. I marked him down with the band as the producers because he had a lot of great vision and a lot of great ideas. And it really has renewed the band's sound in the best possible way, in sound-wise, production-wise, arrangement-wise, song-wise. There's a lot of dynamics and a good, as an entirety, it really felt perfectly into place. So I'm quite happy. I think it's exceptional. One of the best ones I've done, I think, in my career.
Definitely. I mean, honestly, I mean, don't blush here, but I'm going to read out a couple of little things here that I've found on reviews. I mean, the record has gone down a storm. Music Wave said, Michael Munro succeeds with I Live Too Fast to Die Young to release one of the best opus of his talented career. Louder Sound said, Michael Munro continues to be the living embodiment of the rock and roll dream. Rock Pit says, it's an album of wonderful variety. And Sleaze Rock says, for those familiar with The Crown Prince of Cool, I Live Too Fast to Die Young will be of little surprise as Michael Sound absolutely stunning. The reviews have been fantastic. It does sound fantastic. I mean, you must be so pleased with the way it's come out and the recognition it's been getting.
Yeah, that was fantastic. Wow. I wish I had those reviews. That's great. Thank you so much. That's nice to hear. That really means the world to me. That's great to hear. And yeah, I've read other great reviews. It's really been received well and people think it's one of the best records I've done. I agree, I must say. Yeah. It really turned out perfect.
It's fantastic. And then we've got to mention Slash as well. I mean, he's been a good friend of yours for a very long time. And you got him on the record too, didn't you?
Yeah. He plays a solo on the title track, I Live Too Fast to Die Young. And we're actually making, I mean, the videos came out for the Can't Stop Falling Apart and everything. Everybody's Nobody. Yeah. And there's a lyric video for Murder, the Summer of Love. But we're also making, we just filmed two new videos, one for Derelict Palace, which is one of my favorites too. It's very loads of new, which kind of vibe to it. And the title track, which Slash is going to be featured on as well, that's going to be coming up after Derelict Palace. So we're still, you know, coming up with videos for this. This is too good a record to let it, you know, go by.
Yes.
We're still, those songs are coming out on video and we're going to keep touring on it still. And Slash was so sweet. I mean, he was really busy. He was, and he was, he asked me, when do you need to, I said, well, I'd like to play a solo on the song. It's going to be the title track of my new album. And it's like, well, he's really busy. He's got a new album coming out. He's got tons of press to do. When do you need it by? As well, now. But if you can't, I understand. And it was within 2 days we had the solo.
So wow.
God bless you. He's a sweetheart. He's the sweetest guy I know. He's really wonderful.
Fantastic. So how did all that come about? Because obviously you were on the Use Your Illusion album. You were over there. I mean, how did the link up with the Guns N' Roses originally start then?
Well, it started with Axl Rose walking into my video shoot of Dead Jello Rock and Roll in 89 in New York. He was just happened to be walking by, and I'm sure it was a higher guidance. It was meant to be there. He asked some people what's going on, and somebody said, it's Michael Munro filming a video. So he came to introduce himself. And then we got along so well that he ended up on doing a cameo on the video. And then we became friends. And then they flew me over to L.A. to jam on some. For example, there was a magazine called Rit Magazine. They had a party, and they had me come up to play harp on, like, we did the Heartbreak Hotel. And that's where I met Alice Cooper for the first time too. Party. So we became friends, and whenever they came to New York, we would hang out, you know. And one night me and we were out having dinner with Axl and Slash and their management, and me and Slash ended up coming to my apartment later at night, and the management were really nervous. They said, oh, Michael Munro, you know, my reputation. They thought, oh, this is bad news. Slash is going to go off with Michael into the night in New York. What's going to happen? Then I end up, you know, no one's going to hear of them for a month. But we were cool. You know, we had a good time hanging out in my flat. And whenever Axel came to New York, he would always call, and we'd go out to dinner, and it was always really a nice gentleman. And we had great conversations, really deep conversations with spiritual stuff, and probably stuff that the regular LA people wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Guys in LA were more like about chicks and
kind of
more superficial. So when we met, we had nice conversations over dinner, and really deep, you know. He had his tarot cards done for the first time when we were at the restaurant called Nirvana. It was an Indian restaurant on Central Park South, which had like, it was, you went, took an elevator to a penthouse, and there was a view of the park. And
wow.
My favorite, apparently it was Robert Plant's favorite Indian in New York too. So there was, they had live music, some, you know, sitar and tabla players there every Saturday. And then there was a tarot card reader. So I said, you think I should have my card set? I said, yeah, go for it. And yeah, this woman, do his cards, and he thought it was helpful. It was good, and we had some really, really cool conversations. There was one where he said they had a video. He was on stage at a show once, and he felt somebody push him from behind. Where he like it flew ahead, and I was like, "Whoa!" But then he didn't see anybody there, and they watched the video, and they see him like fly forward, but there was nobody there. So I mean, he has some serious demons, you know. Mm-hmm. Chasing them. I was like, wow, that's heavy, man. So yeah, really cool, smart, and smart guy, and really polite, and always friendly to me. I mean, I don't care what they say. I've heard about the stories. I love the guy. I think he's great, and I think he's doing a great job now with opening up for them in London. You know, I thought he was singing great, and you know, I know they canceled a gig in Glasgow after it, because some voice problems. To me, it was great, you know, really good. And I'm so glad that they're still touring, and because they're a real band, you know. And
brilliant. And you said that you supported them, and then you've mentioned Alice a few times as well. You're a big fan of his early albums, and you're a friend of his. You've toured with him again this summer across Europe, that sort of thing. I mean, what's Alice like to hang out with? I mean, what's he like?
Wonderful. He's so sweet. You'd be surprised. He was like the sweetest guy you'll ever meet. He's just like so polite, so kind. And before, and the first time I was at that Rip magazine party, and the first time we met, I knew Alice was there, and there was a bunch of people there, and I was like looking around, and then somebody pulled my sleeve and said, "Hey, Mike." I was like, "Oh, Alice, wow." Hey, and I said, "Come on, sit down." And he says, "Hey, first of all, he thanked me for speaking so highly of these records, because I'd mentioned that Billion Dollar Babies or Love You to Death are my favorite records of all time, some of the best records that I made." And he was like, "Thank you for speaking so highly of my records." And he says, "Shall we take some photos then?" You know, before you even get to ask him. And he was so lovely. I mean, this summer, opening for him, those shows in Europe, it was so great. It was the best times since the Motorhead tour. That's the best tour I've been on. The Alice shows, because they were so, the whole crew and the band and everybody, they're so sweet and so accommodating and kind. And Alice was on my birthday, like the best birthday ever. It was actually June 17th when I turned 60, and we were opening for Alice in Zwickau in Germany. So Alice knew it was my birthday. So he and other nights too, he invited me up to sing the second verse of School's Out. And So this time he invited me up, and he, you know, it was my birthday. He, you know, he has those balloons that have like confetti inside, and he pops them with his sword. So he gave me my own sword. So I always would pop those balloons. I was like, wow, this is a dangerous combination. Me with a sword. But then he, at the end of School's Out, he had a cake brought up for me. Oh. Birthday cake with this guy, Kyler, who's his assistant. He's dressed like the Hunchback of Notre Dame. You know, it comes up with me a cake, and Alice sang Happy Birthday to me with the audience. And I was like, wow, that was the best birthday ever. I was like, whoa, he's so kind-hearted, such a nice guy. And his wife, Cheryl, is amazing too. And they're the coolest couple ever. I mean, me and Cheryl is the dancer, you know, in the show as well. Yeah. She does the splits. We always do like, okay, you still do the splits? Okay, let's do it. We always update our splits photo. We're doing the splits. And she, it's amazing at her age too. It's like they're forever young. I mean, you can't tell what age they are, but they're ageless. They're like totally amazing people. I love them. I love them dearly. Got these knives. This one has, it's what Alice uses. This guy's his autograph on it too, but he has dartboard in the backstage, and he'd be like, "Are you throwing darts?" "Oh no, target practice." He's like, "I'll teach you too." He says, and at the end of a tour, he had he came up to me and says, "Now, Michael, I've only given this to about five people. As Bernie Taupin was one, and one was Nick Cave, and this."
Stiletto. Oh wow!
This, I was like, "Wow, Alice Cooper, and you know, with the pearl handle and everything." I was, "Wow, this is so cool." The stiletto from Alice Cooper. So I posted a picture with this on the Facebook, and somebody, of course, said, "So I said, I got this cool stiletto. I got this cool switchblade from Alice Cooper." And so somebody said, of course, somebody commented, "What's cool about switchblade?" Wild. If Alice Cooper gives you a switchblade, it's freaking cool, okay? I'm my treasure. Actually, we use this. It's probably going to end up in the Derelict Palace video when there's that part where it says, "This Hall of Mirrors leaves me cracked." You know, had this on the video. So
fantastic.
The sweetest, he's the greatest, and I hope we get to do more shows with him.
I hope you do too. It sounds phenomenal. I could sit and speak to you all night, honestly. It's fantastic, Michael. But we've gone through your new movie that's coming up, Demolition 23, the newly remastered version of Oriental Beat. You've got a new album out as well, I Live Too Fast to Die Young. Is there anything else on the horizon? Are you working on anything else that fans can look forward to?
Keep going, keep doing my shows and playing live. I mean, we're supposed to tour in the UK in February if all goes well. And just keep doing my thing and try to get better at it. There's always room for improvement. So that keeps me hungry. And I keep, you know, doing my thing and stay true to myself and honest to from the heart. And I'll just keep on keeping on. And all these cool things are happening. So this is, I'd say this is the best time of my life. People ask, what's your highlights of your career back in the 80s or something? No, this is the best time of our life. One of the highlights was having Alice Cooper sing Happy Birthday to me at the live show in Germany with the whole audience, and having, the best band I could hope for. And I'm very happy. I have a wonderful wife for 18 years now and two lovely cats. And I love my home and, what more can you ask for? I'm quite happy to be.
Life is good, and I'm so glad to hear that life is good for you, Michael. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. I've been a fan since I was a teenager, so this has been a brilliant experience for me as well. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. I truly appreciate it. It was really a great, great experience talking to you too. Thank you.
The brilliant Michael Munro there, such a nice guy. I could have chatted with him all night. Please do check out his latest album, I Live Too Fast to Die Young. It's hard and balls to the wall. Some great songs on there as well. And check out Demolition 23 when it hits. And honestly, I'm so looking forward to the release of the documentary too. Fingers crossed he gets over to the UK to perform in February, and I will be there for sure. But that's it for today's show then. I really do hope you enjoyed that interview. He was brilliant, wasn't he? Check out Hanai Rocks, such a criminally underexposed band. Go give their albums a listen. Check out the live performances on YouTube as well. Go and do it now. One heck of a live band they were. Remember as well, if you're not listening to this on the Vintage Rock Pod feed, then please do search for it on your podcast app. Follow, subscribe, whatever it is, to the Vintage Rock Pod channel so you don't miss any of the episodes, because one is released every single day. It's everything for the classic rock fan. Check out the Vintage Rock Pod feed and see us on YouTube as well. Vintage Rock Pod with all the videos. You'll see some of the Michael Munro videos that have been going up lately as well. But that is it for this week's big interview show. Thanks again for listening and checking out the program. I'll be back tomorrow with another of This Day Rocks. So remember, if you come across anyone who isn't a fan of rock, just tell them, my music is better than yours. Take care.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.